We know from Scripture it says that whenever two or more are gathered in your name, that you're here in our midst in a special way. And I pray that you'll be with our class here today, both as Dr. Huroff shares. I pray that you'll be with us as we talk about the ministries here in the class after lunch. And I pray that you'll help prepare our hearts coming up for Thanksgiving, Lord. We're so thankful that we live in a nation that sets aside a day to give thanks to you, Lord. I pray that we would each day count our blessings, Lord, that you would fill our hearts with overflowing with joy, knowing that no matter what trials or tribulations come into our life, that you can use those for good, you can use those for your purposes, for your goals, and that we can find blessings even in the midst of our trials and our suffering. I pray that you help us to call upon you, Lord, because we know that you care for us. Be with Hugh as he teaches today. Amen. I've asked Hugh to share something that he shared personally with a few other people, and so he's going to do that. So if you could let him finish this one thing, sharing about recent experiences at a memorial service, I'd appreciate it because I would like to hear it. And others.
Well, last time I was here, which was two Sundays ago, I was sharing about a conference that I'd been speaking at in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I was going to also talk a little bit about the memorial service I did for my mother-in-law. We never got there. I never even got to finish the report I gave. I mean, it was a very entertaining class with all the questions and discussion we had. I never regret that. That's one of the reasons I really enjoy leading this class. But I was asked if I could lead off with a little report because it was an unusual memorial service. What I appreciate about being a member of Kathy's family is that I get to talk to people when they know they're coming close to the door of death and get to kind of arrange the service ahead of time as to how they want it. And, my mother-in-law had been a Christian ever since she was a little child. And one of the things, we wound up inheriting her little easy chair that she sat in for like 30, 40 years in her home. And I found that there was a little sleeve in the chair and it was loaded with notes from her Bible. And so I just read through all those in preparing to conduct the graveside service. And what I found was a sheaf of notes, which was basically her outline for the prayers of every member of the family. And she prayed 90 minutes a day for the family. And so basically I just kind of read for people. It says, this is what, you know, Myrtle Drake had been praying for each one of you all these past 30-plus years. And how she kept updating it. So I shared the one that was the last time that she was able to pray. Because, you know, for the last 4.5 years she's been in a rest home with fairly severe dementia. And that's what took her home. And she died while Kathy and I were in Charlotte. That was kind of hard on Kathy, not being there when she did die, but I'm not sure it would have made that much difference. She had ceased to recognize even one of us. And she simply refused to eat her dinner one night, and then 4 hours later they found her dead in bed. So it was completely unexpected. But it was one of what was different about the memorial service, I've never done a memorial service that turned into an outreach for strangers. This one did. Mm-hmm. And, all the relatives said, you know, we don't want it to be inside of a church, or we want it to be at the gravesite. So everything was at the gravesite. You know, after I shared what she had been praying for each one of us for the past 30 years, different relatives stood up and testified of what her life meant in terms of their walk with Jesus Christ. And there were people in the background that were putting flowers on the graves of different relatives, but they began to kind of congregate at our back of our little meeting. And I actually got to talk to them afterwards, and they just said, you know, we were hearing things we've never heard before at a funeral. And it was just so moving, we decided to join you. And so we had this whole family, including little children, that joined us for the event. And, it was, I think, quite touching in the fact that every relative was there to share how my mother-in-law, Myrtle, had actually had a big impact on their life and their ministry. And, you know, most of Kathy's relatives are in some kind of ministry, not fully paid like we are, but they really integrate their faith with their job, kind of like what Ross was talking about. It becomes part of you. And, you know, that's where the real mission field is. It's where we work and where we associate with other people. So it was a blessing to me because I've never seen an event like that turn into an outreach for strangers. So I think from now on, I like the gravesite idea. So it helped that it was good weather, too. So, but I was gone last Sunday, and I was at a different kind of apologetics conference. Had these two apologetics conferences back to back. The one in North Carolina had been run for 17 consecutive years. The one that we just did in Austin, Texas, it's the first time they've ever done an apologetics conference, although technically the second. They did a conference last year on the arts and Christianity. This one was on science and Christianity. That's the first time they did one in science and Christianity, but they kind of included a lot of people from the arts. And they quickly found out that there's two different kinds of people in the Christian community. Those that appreciate dance and singing and artistic expression, and those who really couldn't frankly care less about such activities. Or, as one of the artists said, you know, this conference, everybody seems to be autistic. And, so... Well, I'm autistic myself. I felt right at home. So, but it is, I mean, there really was a difference. And the other big difference is that the conference in North Carolina had been dominated by young earth creationists for the past 16 years. This is the first time we actually got an invitation to speak. And as I shared with you a couple of weeks ago, what hit me is that here's a group of people, 2,000-3,000 people attending this kind of conference on a yearly basis, and they'd never heard the best scientific evidences for the Christian faith. You know, the plenary session I gave, which I just simply say, you know, review the latest and what you think are the strongest scientific evidences for the God of the Bible, and just realizing this is an audience that had never heard it before. I got the same reaction at this Austin conference. And this is a conference that was dominated by theistic evolutionists, and then we got invited to join them. So we were the one group that got to go to both apologetics conferences. So often I think Christians are told you either choose young earth creationism or theistic evolution. They don't realize that there's another alternative. But once again, I found I was talking to an audience who had never heard these evidences before. As I shared with you 2 weeks ago, there's something about the young earth paradigm that doesn't want to look at these evidences, because the best scientific evidence of the Christian faith are very disturbing to someone from a young earth perspective. But it really is showing me that the vast majority of the Christian community hasn't been touched with the kind of evidences that we kind of take for granted in this class and have people reasons to believe hear about ad nauseum. But I think there was one lecture I heard there that was particularly insightful for me and Fuzz. Fuzz Rana, my colleague, was there, along with Jeff Swearing. And Fuzz and I did get to give a plenary session. I think what was good is that, you know, in Charlotte, I had to summarize the best scientific evidences in one plenary session. Fuzz and I each got a plenary session. So I had the joy of just focusing on the simple sciences. He had to deal with the complex sciences. So, and there was a talk ahead of time explaining the difference between simple science and complex science, which really was great for Fuzz and me in our plenary sessions, trying to explain to audiences why things are so cut and dried and definitive within mathematics, physics, and astronomy and geophysics, but where things get really fuzzy and complex and incomplete once you get into the biological sciences. So it really helped have a plenary session ahead of time that kind of explained that difference and why it's so important to interpret the complex sciences in light of the simple sciences. And so I spoke first and kind of laid out the boundary conditions that the simple sciences impose upon the biological sciences. And I gave a good segue for Fuzz to jump in. But what we recognize from the response we got afterwards is here are people who have been studying apologetics from a theistic evolutionary perspective literally for decades and have not been exposed to these evidences. Even in their own discipline of biology, they hadn't been exposed to the best evidences for the God of the Bible. And after we spoke, a fellow at Baylor University, longtime friend of mine, Walt Bradley, he gave a lecture. It should have been at the beginning of the three-day conference, but it was at the end. And what he explained is there are four different ways of looking at science and faith. And he basically took it from a book that had just been published by Michael Ruse. He was the editor, but it was basically a series of lectures where they discuss these four different perspectives. And the first of them is something called separate magisteria, based on a very famous article published by Stephen Gould, in which he argued that there's no basis for conflict between science and faith because science deals with one magisterium and religion and faith deals with a completely separate magisterium where there's no overlap between the two worlds. No overlap because the science magisterium deals with reason and facts, and the religion and faith magisterium deals with feelings and issues of the spirit. And he saw them as completely different. But I've read the article that Gould presented, and you know, it has a strong patronizing tone where it kind of pats people who believe in God on the head and says, well, you know, we understand that you're driven by your feelings. We scientists are driven by facts and the reason. So, but understandable given the theological perspective of Stephen Gould. And then Walter Bradley described a second way of dealing with faith and science, which is the conflict paradigm, that the two do overlap. The world of science and the world of faith do overlap. They're not separate, but they're at war with one another. And it's a drag-out battle to see who's going to win and who's going to lose. And in people that we would associate with that perspective, I guess Richard Dawkins would be the most famous, who says that science is in a war with religion and science is going to win, and we need to stamp out from this earth and our human population all those who believe in God. But on the Christian side, we can name a number of people. I mean, Answers in Genesis certainly takes a war perspective on science and faith and how the Bible is going to trump science and to put scientists in their place. Others in this category that have been named by both Bradley and by Michael Ruse would be Stephen Hawking, Victor Stenger, basically Sam Harris, the new atheists that are out there. Take this perspective that there's a war going on, and there's going to be a battle, and one's going to be completely vanquished, and there'll be a victor. And depending which side you're on, you'd be predicting a different victor. A third position is labeled as, what have I got down here? Complementary. And the complementary perspective is that you've got faith and religion here, and it's not quite as cut and dried as separate magisteria, and that one deals with facts and the other deals with feelings. Rather, they break it up this way, that science deals with what happens and how it happens, but does not address the why. And whereas faith and religion deal with the why, but they don't deal with the how and the what. And therefore, there's really no conflict between the two because they have different goals. The fields overlap. They would say that faith and science do overlap, but because faith is focused only on the why issues and science is only focused on the what and the how, that there's really no battle or conflict between the two. Now, you've heard me say here in the class, and Walter Bradley also made the point, that you really can't do good science if you ignore the why issue. I mean, once you get into what happens, it leads to the issue, well, if I really want to understand what happens, how does it happen? And you discover things when you ask the how questions. But also when you begin to say why, then you begin to understand the how. So good science can't be done unless you ask the why questions. That's how we build sound scientific models, is by asking why does it happen in this way? And why does it happen that you get this how perspective? And likewise, I would argue you can't do good theology if all you look at is the why. I mean, after all, when you pick up this book, it's filled with what happens. You know, a good third of this book is history, telling you what happened and what order it happened, and then how it happened and why it happened. So in that sense, you'd be forced to conclude, I think, that religion and faith isn't just dealing with the how issues. The last position that Walter Bradley addresses, one called constructive integration, where you get the two overlapping and they're completely complementary, not only in the why, but the how and the what as well. And how this is something that the Reformation taught, that God gave us two books, the Book of Nature and the Book of Scripture. Both are utterly trustworthy and reliable. They overlap considerably and they support one another. And then Walter made the comment, he says, there's very few people that take that position today. In fact, he says, I can only name two people who would be recognized as leaders in this perspective, and it was Ross and Ronna. So, but Walter and I talked afterwards, and he said, you know, it's really sad how far the Christian community has left its Reformation roots, and how few that are out there that are really engaging in this model of constructive integration. But as we continue to talk, and we were on some panel discussions together, is that there's a reason why we don't see the level of constructive integration today that we did during the Reformation. We're in the 21st century. We're in a much more technologically advanced era and a much more information-saturated era. It's really not possible to for any one individual to fully integrate. I mean, I feel the challenges myself of trying to integrate across all the scientific disciplines and all the different books of the Bible. And you really need a team. And the problem is, even our team at Reasons to Believe is nowhere big enough to be able to do a thorough job of constructive integration. And most scholars in the field, whether they be Bible scholars or scientists, are forced by the nature of the technology and information to specialize. And so we're in an era where we know a whole lot about highly specialized subjects, but very few of us are able to integrate across the specialties. And so there's a lot of discussion about what we can do to kind of get back to our Reformation roots, but realize all the pathways are difficult. It's difficult to pull together the appropriate scholars and the sufficient mass. And I said, yeah, that's one of our goals at Reasons to Believe, is to build a critical mass of scholars so that we can do justice to the job of integration. But already we're the largest old earth creationist organization in the world, and we're nowhere near the size we need to be. And what's interesting is the organizations that specialize are far bigger than we are. And so again, the energies are moving in the direction of specialization in terms of funding within the church, but that's also true within the secular arena in terms of integrating the different books of the Bible. And we began to see that quite explicitly in a number of the talks that were given. You know, I really appreciated the fact that Walt Kaiser was there. He's probably the preeminent Old Testament scholar that's alive today. You know, fluent in 8 different languages. Gleason Archer was fluent in 27. And Gleason Archer and Walter Kaiser were friends until Gleason died a few years ago. And so Walter's kind of taking over where Gleason left off. But what I loved about Walter, I sat on 6 panels. Well, he was on 4 panels that I was on, and he also got to speak quite a bit. But whenever the tension got high, he would say, it's time for a joke. And so he would jump in with a joke. And, you know, if you've ever seen him on the debate DVD we have here over at the table, he comes across very serious and scholarly. But I can tell you, during all the breaks we had in the filming of that debate, he was cracking jokes one after the other. And we should have captured some of those on the DVD, but that didn't happen. But one of the things he said is, you all know that I'm an Old Testament scholar. But he says, I want to tell all of you that I read the New Testament once and I really liked it. But he was the one that pointed out the crisis that the church is in today. And, you know, the theistic evolutionary paradigm that we saw at this conference, I mean, one of the things we realize, it's a big spectrum of people that take that theistic evolutionary label. But the one that predominated at this conference was one that kind of looked at, yes, we're all descended from Adam and Eve, but Adam and Eve are not specially created by God. Maybe spiritually, but definitely not physically. We're the product of naturalistic evolution from a common ancestor with the chimpanzees, orangutans, and gorillas. That was kind of the paradigm that was being presented. And what I realize is they're resting their entire case on the one scientific discipline of human genomics. And they admitted that they were all specialists in human genomics. But because they were so specialized, they had a hard time seeing how what they were interpreting from human genomics was not in sync with what scientists are interpreting with the other scientific disciplines. And then realizing that, you know, what we're seeing in these conferences was the problem of over-specialization. What we were seeing at the conference in Charlotte was looking at what the Bible's got to say about creation from the perspective of just one book, namely the book of Genesis. And I remember at that conference talking about the creation accounts in Psalms and Proverbs and Job that we've been discussing here in class. And I got a very negative reaction from people, the leaders there, saying Genesis is the primary account of creation, the only one we should look at. And so, again, and their whole point was all these other creation accounts that we talk about here at Reasons to Believe are written in poetry. And a poetry is something that needs to be interpreted in the light of narrative. And that really got Walt Kaiser upset, and I shared that with him. He says, that's horrible hermeneutics. He says, you know, the hermeneutic principle is that we're to interpret the narrative in light of the didactic. And didactic is a word for a text that's primarily teaching in its perspective or doctrinal in its perspective. And his comment is, which I very much agree with, is that there are didactic passages in Scripture that are pure poetry. There are didactic passages that are prose. But you won't find them in the narrative. And the idea that we're to use narrative to interpret didactic is just totally out of sync with what the church has taught about the principles of interpretation literally for centuries. But that's one reason that's been given for rejecting these creation accounts, but I can see why. If you give any credence to the creation accounts in Job and Psalms and Proverbs and Isaiah, your old earth or your young earth perspective is toast. Those are the scriptures that really make it extremely difficult to hold a young earth perspective. This is a reason why they gravitate to Genesis only. At both conferences, we had some representatives from the intelligent design movement. And the thing that Fuzz and I both noticed, their entire science apologetic for the Christian faith is focused on a subdiscipline of biochemistry. Basically, how complicated and hard it is to take amino acids and nucleotides and sugars and put them together into proteins, DNA, and RNA, and put all that together in a cell. That's basically their entire argument. But I can see why they argue that way. It does not force them to take a position on the age of the earth. But it does mean that they're using the weakest of the biochemical arguments, not the strongest. Fortunately, Fuzz got to speak about that directly. How when you look at the origin of life, you realize that there's a huge problem in the sense that you don't even get to start with amino acids, nucleotides, and sugars. There's no soup. There's no soup on the earth, and there's no soup anywhere in the universe. And for that reason alone, a naturalistic interpretation for the origin of life is physically impossible. If you haven't got any building blocks to start with, it's really immaterial whether or not you can put those building blocks together along some naturalistic pathway. Now, I do agree with my intelligent design friends. If you begin with the building blocks of amino acids and nucleotides and sugars, it's theoretically impossible for any naturalistic pathway to assemble those into DNA, RNA, and proteins, let alone into a functional cell. So I completely agree with their argument. But the problem is it's relatively complex, it's probabilistic, and it's difficult to use that argument to persuade atheistic biochemists that they need to let go of their naturalistic model. But if you point out to them, you don't even have the building blocks to start with. Moreover, you got what's called the homochirality problem, which is that in order for these things to be assembled, they all have to be left-handed in terms of the amino acids, and the sugars, they all have to be right-handed. And everything in nature tells us that you do not get 100% only left or 100% only right. In fact, there are strong physical principles that prove that it's impossible for the early Earth ever to have a primordial soup. It's called the oxygen ultraviolet paradox. And if you got oxygen in the Earth's environment, that shuts down prebiotic chemistry. If you don't have oxygen in the Earth's environment, ultraviolet radiation comes in from the sun, and that shuts down prebiotic chemistry. And so it's impossible if you got oxygen. It's impossible if you don't have oxygen. Bottom line, it's impossible from a naturalistic perspective.
Are you sure?
Now, you lose both ways. But you also get the same problem with homochirality, is that there are strong physical principles that prove that no naturalistic process will ever deliver 100% left-handed amino acids or 100% right-handed sugars or the reverse. But trying to argue along those lines does force you into an old Earth perspective. It's an old Earth perspective that really establishes the impossibility of the existence of a primordial soup or the impossibility of the homochiral molecules, or the fact that there's no time. I mean, we look at the origin of life, we see that the Earth is in a molten state just previous to the time that life becomes abundant on planet Earth, which means that you have a very infinitesimal geological time scale for the origin of life to take place. And I did have a professor on origin of life. It was none other than Carl Sagan when I was at the University of Toronto. And he argued that nothing less than a billion years was going to be adequate to explain how a primordial soup could provide the building blocks of life, referring to the proteins, DNA, and RNA. And the evidence is now telling us it's a few million years or less, and it might be quite a bit less. So, young Earth perspective, it's Genesis only. The intelligent design movement is a narrow discipline of biochemistry. And at least the brand of theistic evolution we were seeing there, it was a human genomics. So we're just getting narrow disciplines without the integration. But I appreciated Walt Kaiser and also Jack Collins. Jack Collins is a young Hebrew Old Testament scholar. And what's interesting about both Walt Kaiser and Jack Collins, both of them have engineering degrees. In the case of Jack Collins, he's got both a bachelor's and a master's degree in engineering from MIT. Both men are very bright and have been lifelong learners, but both of them sounded this particular alarm. If the church doesn't deal with this challenge of theistic evolution coming from the biologos camp and human genomics, he says the entire church will be in the same camp that liberal theology went down 200 years ago. And basically making the point of how strongly you have Timothy and Paul in Romans and 1 Corinthians and Jesus in the Gospels making the point that we are all descended from Adam and Eve, whom God specially created by miraculous means. And he says, if you're going to give up on that, then you really are throwing out the gospel message. So this is not a trivial issue. And he says it's not just one book of the Bible, it's multiple books of the Bible that teach us. Because he says that what we were hearing from the evolutionists, the theologians behind the theistic evolutionary camp, is that we need to reinterpret Genesis 1. And Genesis 1 is not an account of physical creation events, nor is Genesis 2. It's simply a response to the creation myths that existed at that time. And I was on a panel with a couple of these people, and they were saying, well, you have to agree that the Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 do address the creation myths of its time. And I said, I'm completely comfortable with that. I'm just not comfortable saying that's all Genesis 1 and 2 do. In fact, I think Genesis 1 teaches the doctrine of the Trinity. I think every page of the Bible has multiple messages and multiple purposes. And so limiting the different chapters of the Bible to just one message or one purpose, again, really, in my opinion, attacks the idea that's divinely inspired. If God only gave us one book, I would expect that he would pack into the book as much as he could get into the pages. And, you know, the interesting thing about the Bible, if you look at it from the perspective of the last 3,500 years, it is a big book, but it's not too big of a book. I mean, who would want to carry, a 40-volume set to class every day? So he condensed it into just under 900,000 words. And that's a manageable number of words, not just for the 21st century, but for people living over thousands of years. But given the limitation that you've got to get it into a fairly short text, you would expect that the one that inspired this book would pack it with as much information as possible, and therefore the challenge for all of us is to keep reading this to see if we can discover. In fact, one of the panel discussions, I made the point to the audience that personally I treat the Bible like I do the Astrophysical Journal. Every time an astrophysical journal arrives on my desk, I eagerly read it to see about all the new discoveries that have taken place and how I can integrate those new discoveries into my Christian faith. And, you know, I pick up the Bible the same way. Every time I read it, I'm eagerly anticipating making new discoveries that will help me to live better my Christian faith and integrate it into everything else I know. And this is a book you don't just read once. You read it over and over again, because every time you read it, there's new material there, and you begin to see things you didn't see before. And, every chapter of the Bible indeed has multiple messages and multiple purposes. So God gave us two books, but what I see in Psalm 19, we're commanded to be good research theologians. We're also commanded to be good research scientists. All of us are to do that, and all of us are to be anticipating we will continue to make new discoveries the more that we study that. But it was evident to me, and also to Walt Kaiser and Jack Collins, is that perspective on the Christian faith seems to be diminishing within the Christian church. And in one sense, I agree with both Jack Collins and Walt Kaiser. The church today is at a crisis of faith. And he says, in fact, Walt Kaiser says, we got 5 years to deal with this. If we don't deal with this in 5 years, evangelicalism will be history. So, and he's in his 70s. He's probably the most respected Old Testament scholar from a conservative perspective alive today. And I think he's really onto something. We are facing a serious crisis, and we do need to deal with it. And sometimes I think we don't realize that we need to be all the more fervent in taking our message out there to the masses. And there was one breakout session I was also really interested in where the individual made the comment, 85% of the Christians attending conservative evangelical churches received Christ in their youth. However, those statistics are flawed in this sense. The vast majority of people attending conservative evangelical churches today were raised in Christian homes. And kind of that 85% statistic has gotten people away from the idea that trying to bring adults to faith in Christ is almost impossible. But in fact, what this individual is pointing out, if you separate out from the church, people who came to Christ who were not raised in Christian homes, you discover there's no magic age. They come to Christ at all different points in their life. And my own family is testimony of that. My grandmother became a Christian at age 86. My parents in their late 70s. So if you're not raised in a Christian home, haven't been raised with the Bible since you were a little child, then we should not give up. I mean, people of all ages are receptive. But the other thing that he was pointing out is that people who have come to Christ as an adult who weren't raised in a Christian home, often it's a crisis in their life. A divorce, a death in the family, a serious illness, a son or a daughter who's on drugs, you know, some kind of social crisis that brings them to a point of saying, I've got needs that I can't solve and I need help. But I thought he made a really good insight on this, and where he said, that's because the church is not equipped with reaching out to people outside of the church with solid intellectual evidences for the Christian faith. And so we wait till they're in crisis. And, that really resonated with Fuzz and Jeff and me, is that, there are people out there who are receptive to the Christian faith, but they need to hear some sound evidences. And you don't have to wait till they're in crisis. And I think many of us in class are in that category. It wasn't a crisis that brought us to faith. It was simply realizing there is a Lord out there. There's a Creator out there. And if there's one out there that created all this for me, then surely that Creator is very interested in what's happening in my life and has authority over me, and I need to give that some serious attention. So anyway, that's a brief summary of what happened at that conference. So, but it gave Fuzz and Jeff and I all the more conviction we need to stay focused on our task of constructive integration. And we need to be looking for people who can we can work with to be allied, because we can't do this by ourselves. And that was especially brought on. I got interviewed by Coral Ridge Ministries, which is a breakthrough, because that's been a very strong, staunch Young Earth organization, literally for decades. In fact, the founder of Coral Ridge Ministries wrote some very nasty things about me personally, but he died a few years ago. And for some reason, they decided to interview me, and the interviewer was just stunned by what I was able to share with them. Again, had no idea that these kinds of powerful scientific evidences existed for the existence of the God of the Bible and the inerrancy of the Bible. And I also got interviewed by World Magazine, and again, that's a group that's been ignoring the existence of reasons to believe. So I felt those were two special breakthroughs. And both of them really caught the idea that Walter Bradley was talking about, is that we need to pursue constructive integration. And so I really see some opportunities to start partnering with other people and other organizations to make that happen. Yes, in the back.
What's the
World Magazine used to be called Eternity Magazine. They changed their name a few years ago, so some of you older may remember Eternity Magazine. And it's kind of a Christian news magazine format. I mean, you also got Christianity Today, which is a bigger publication. Christianity Today basically focuses on news within the Christian community and what's happening at a ministerial and theological level. World Magazine is trying to look at world news events, public events, from a Christian perspective. At the same time trying to cover the cutting edge of what's taking place within the Christian community. So they take much more of a news magazine format than, say, Christianity Today. So, but it's the first time I'd ever been interviewed by anybody within that group. Yes?
I really appreciated Ross Hoagland's comment that the head stuff gives permission for the heart stuff.
It does.
And in that vein, I think it's only constructive integration that could play that role for me and give me permission to fervently explore the heart stuff and to encourage me to seriously read the Bible.
Well, that's a very interesting comment, because one speaker at the conference in Austin was making the comment that the church so often leads with a heart and follows with a mind, and we need to do the opposite. Lead with a mind and follow with a heart. And I can tell you that the people that answer our phones at Reasons to Believe, you know, every day we have what's called an apologetics hotline where we invite people to call in with their different skeptical questions that they have. But when they do get their intellectual barriers to the Christian faith removed, it's quite common that they begin to open up their heart about some of the issues in their own life. And I've told our people, look, we need to stay focused on the apologetics. We need to stay focused on removing the intellectual barriers. And when a person reaches that point, refer them to organizations that specialize with marital counseling or, you know, family counseling, financial counseling, because we could easily get diverted. But it does make the point. When you remove people's intellectual barriers, then suddenly they're willing to deal with the hard issues. And to put it in a scriptural context, in Psalm 2, King David said, we come to God first with our minds to be instructed. Then we submit our will and we kiss the Son, making the point that the pathway to a fulfilling emotional relationship with our Creator. And we all heard this from Ross earlier. Ross, I appreciated the way that you kind of laid that out, that, you know, once your intellectual questions got dealt with, then suddenly the heart issues got exposed. And now you have that relationship with the Son, where you really are kissing the Son, to use the terminology in Psalm 2. But the mind comes first, then the will, and then the emotional relationship. And so often the church does it the other way around. They invite non-Christian adults who've never been to church to come to a concert where they can get their emotions stirred up, and they make an appeal to the will and say, now we want you to sign up for a class where you can find out that all this stuff is true. That works for some people. But what we see from King David's mouth is that a better way is to reach the mind first, give them the instruction they need, answer their questions, and then that's when you encourage them to submit their will and enjoy a fulfilling relationship with the Creator of the universe. And what I find fascinating is here's Psalm 2, the second psalm in the Bible, and King David is talking about the Son of God all the way through. You know, how interesting from a Jewish perspective that, you know, here's King David talking about God's Son all the way down the line, how to relate to God's Son. So sometimes I share that with my Jewish friends. You see, look what it says here. Yeah, go ahead.
Illustrate with just one or two brief examples today how other disciplines that you mentioned present problems for the genomics of theistic evolutionist paradigm.
Well, kind of what we were hearing from these people presenting the human genomics is they were looking at the analysis of the human genome compared with a chimpanzee genome, seeing the similarities, and concluding this proves that we evolved naturalistically from a common ancestor. Now, I would admit that's one way to interpret the data, but it's not the only way to interpret the data. Moreover, the data's not all in. I mean, you know, they mentioned the Neanderthal genome, but it's called a draft for good reason. And the people who published the Neanderthal genome made the point, as I told you here in the class, it's about two-thirds at best complete, and the other one-third will probably never be able to recover. I've heard one of the speakers say, you know, this is so cut and dry, it's like the law of gravity. And, you know, as a physicist, that was offensive to me. Because, you know, when we look at particle physics or the four fundamental laws, things are really cut and dried and highly predictive. And now we're dealing with a fairly complete databases. And, you know, we know how this applies to the entire universe. To make that same kind of claim for genomics, to me, is just simply failing to appreciate the limitations of the research. And fortunately, we had people there in the field who are making the point, yes, this is model dependent. There are many different ways of looking at the data, and we don't have the complete picture yet. We still have a lot more to learn about the human genome, the chimpanzee genome, the Neanderthal genome, and moreover, it could be evidence for naturalistic descent, but it could also be evidence that you have a God supernaturally intervening to repeat DNA designs. And the real debate at the conference was over, okay, these little snippets of the DNA that we're seeing in the human genome that are identical to what we see in the chimpanzee genome, are they simply garbage left over from some evolutionary descent, or do they really serve a purpose that we have yet to discover? And for that matter, Fuzz was there to speak, and Fuzz pointed out there have been 10 papers published in 2010 alone that are identifying purpose for what has been claimed as evidence for common descent. And so he was particularly cognizant of the fact that the people presenting this as an open and shut case weren't up to date on the latest literature on genomics. So, and his whole point is, he made this case at the conference. He says, you know, this is not a settled issue, and this is a great opportunity for us to put our competing models of creation interpretation and evolutionary interpretation to the test. Let's see how this plays out as we learn more and more. But from Fuzz's perspective, there's already a very good track record if you look at the past 5 or 10 years of research.
Hasn't over 90% of the junk DNA, so-called, now been found to have purpose?
Well, I mean, just to be fair to people from BioLogos, they would argue that in some cases, function has been definitely identified. In other places, it's strongly suggested. And in other places, It could be and it may not be. They're convinced that as we continue to research this, there will be huge amounts of junk that can't be identified as having any purpose. So, but one thing I found that there was really not adequate discussion on, which we've mentioned here already, is, you know, we need to be looking at more than just the chimpanzee genome and more than just the Neanderthal genome. I mean, we have remarkable similarity with the genomes of mice and rats. And, you know, why is that there? In fact, I made a comment during one of the panel discussions. There's a reason why we see these DNA similarities. God anticipated our medical research and gave us certain animals that we could use for medical research as substitutes for human beings. You know, God places a much higher value on human beings than he does, say, mice, rats, and chimpanzees. And therefore, it would be ethical to be using those creatures for medical experiments than, say, six-year-old children. And God gave us these animals on purpose. And I think the evidence for that is we see DNA identity with mice and rats that we don't see with chimpanzees. I mean, from an evolutionary perspective, you'd have to argue we have a common ancestor with mice when it comes to those particular attributes. You know, you heard me speak about this before. With mice and rats, you see DNA that is similar to human DNA that governs the energy pathways and metabolic pathways that govern brain function and memory in particular that the chimpanzees and the orangutans don't have. So, and you know, how ravens can manifest certain identities with our brain function that you don't see in the higher apes.
I think it's 30% of daffodils.
Yeah, our genome, I think it's about 35% of the daffodil genome overlaps that of the human genome. But for obvious reasons, all life is based on metabolic pathways, chemical pathways. And so we process sugar the same way the daffodils process sugar. So, of course, you're going to have the same DNA in both eyes, in both species. And the whole point there is, you know, if God's responsible, he's going to use optimal designs over and over again. Unfortunately, at this conference, we had a very limited discussion of Simon Conway Morris's model of repeated evolutionary outcomes. The theistic evolutionist right away saw what was coming and changed the subject. And Fuzz was trying to stay on topic there, saying, you know, this is really a critical distinction between our model and the theistic evolutionary models, how we see these repeated outcomes in these different species of life, both today and in the past, and both at a biochemical level and at the whole body form level. And, you know, if it's natural descent, then we shouldn't be seeing all these repeated outcomes, but we do. The evolutionists refer to it as repeated evolutionary outcomes. We refer to it as repeated creation outcomes. And the whole point there is what's optimal for a sand lance fish is also going to be optimal for the chameleon reptile. Two completely different environments, clearly not related to one another in any kind of evolutionary paradigm, but they have the identical anatomical equipment in terms of the way their eyes function, the eyelids function, and the way the tongue works, and their hunting strategies, completely identical all the way down the line. And again, you see that repeatedly. And with respect to human beings, there's a lot that we see in our physiology that's identical to what we see in other creatures. You know, we get leprosy just like armadillos get leprosy. And so since their DNA at that level is identical to ours, we're able to use use armadillos to gain a cure for leprosy. And likewise, we're using mice and rats to deal with such issues as human dementia. And we're not using the chimpanzees because they don't have the same structures we do at that level or the metabolic pathways, but mice do. So we can use mice for medical advance. And it makes sense from a creator's perspective, he would give us multiple species that would be identical to us in different ways. That's really the best way to sustain human medical research. So when you have Thanksgiving in a couple of weeks, you might want to say a word about thanking God for making the DNA of mice and rats identical to us with respect to how it governs the metabolic pathways for memory. I also might want to say a word of thanks for the armadillo. And also say a word of thanks for the chimpanzees and the gorillas. Because of the way our DNA is so similar to their DNA, we can actually take organs out of those creatures and use them to replace diseased organs in human beings. You know, that research is still ongoing, but there's a reason why they take a kidney from a chimpanzee or a heart from a baboon. It's because of how close it is to what we have in the human body. By the way, pigs are a lot closer to us, too. So you might want to suggest that your relative has a common ancestor with a pig when it comes to Thanksgiving as well.
Unless
so.
They're Jewish, don't know that.
All right. Go ahead.
How about it eating? If we weren't like the other species, would we still be able to eat them? Plants or animals?
Well, it is true that, as I've already stated, that we share common metabolic pathways in the way our cells operate. That explains a lot of the DNA identity you see in different species of life. That's all optimized. And that also makes it possible for us to eat the plants and eat the animals. So, yeah, you're right on that point. You're next, and I'll come to you. Go ahead.
In the Old Testament, you had mentioned some of the Psalms of David where he refers to the Son of God.
Right.
Because that was one of the questions
Psalm 2.
I want to ask you, is where in the Old Testament does it prophesize that there will be the Son of God, not just a Son of God, but also the resurrection and performing the miracles? You wouldn't happen to have that off the top of your head of the chapters and verses.
Yeah, I actually do. So another place you want to go is Psalm 22. So Psalm 2 is where, that's the first psalm where it speaks directly about God's Son.
This is the David section, King David section?
Yeah. Sorry. I will proclaim the decree of the Lord. It says in verse 5 of Psalm 2, He said to me, You are my Son, today I've become your Father. Ask of me and I'll make the nations your inheritance, the ends of the earth your position. You will rule them with an iron scepter. You will dash them to pieces like pottery. Now, that's a phrase that you see picked up in different passages of the Old Testament, referring to the coming Messiah. It says, Therefore, you kings, be wise. Be warned, you rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you be destroyed in your way. For his wrath can flare up in a moment. Blessed are those who take refuge in him. So, this is loaded with a lot of the theology of the fact that the Son of God is the one who created the universe. He is the one who redeems you from your sin, and he is the one that you need to submit to and form a relationship with him. So it all begins here in Psalm 2. But as you go through the Psalms of David, he's also responsible for Psalm 22. And Psalm 22, what you'll see there, is a detailed prophetic message of what's going to happen when the Son of God comes in human form on planet Earth. It predicts 700 years before it was invented that he would die a death of crucifixion. So that's remarkable. Here's King David, 1,000 years before Christ comes, 700 years before crucifixion was used as an execution tool, giving a detailed account about how he would be put to death. And it even gives an account of the words of mockery that would be thrown at him as he was dying on the cross. And so Psalm 22 speaks about how the religious leaders of that time would mock him as he was dying on the cross. Also even predicts that his side would be pierced. And it talks about how he'd be given vinegar. What's interesting is when you read Psalm 22, it begins with the phrase, my God, why have you forsaken me? And it ends with a sentence, it is finished. So what were the first words that Christ said when he was put up on the cross? My God, why have you forsaken me? It's recorded in the gospel accounts. And just before he died, it is finished. Consequently, a number of Bible scholars of the New Testament argue that when Jesus was dying on the cross, he was quoting verbatim Psalm 22. And so he is basically putting back to the religious leaders what had been predicted of them 1,000 years earlier. And what it tells us in the gospel accounts, all this is being witnessed by the centurion, the Roman centurion. in charge of the crucifixion. And when Jesus said in the cross, "It is finished," and he died, he gave his last breath, what the text tells us is the centurion said, "Surely, this was the Son of God."
I know this is extremely skeptical, but could Jesus have been doing that to make himself fit the Messiah? See what I'm saying? He did come in on the donkey because he read that the Messiah would be coming in on the donkey. Oh, well, I was born in Bethlehem. That gives me a heads up here. Do you see what I'm saying?
No, you're right. I mean, a lot of Jews have argued that way. And this is something I dealt with before I gave my life to Christ, is saying, okay, I need to study this. And what I discovered is there were numerous Jews who tried to fulfill through their own efforts the prophecies of the coming Messiah, the most famous of which has the name Bar-Jesus. And Bar-Jesus, with a lot of help, and he had financial help, he was able to fulfill 8 of the prophecies that are in the Old Testament about the coming Son of God. Only 8. Jesus fulfilled 123. And by the way, there was one other guy that was able to fulfill 2. So when you look at what Jesus was able to fulfill in his life compared to the competition, you know, one got 8 prophecies taken care of, one got 2, he got 123. And of those 123, the vast majority were beyond his control. For example, it was beyond his control the exact sum of money he would be sold for in betrayal. Because, you know, Zechariah says he would be betrayed for the price of 30 pieces of silver. Now, that's something he had no control over, but it happened.
Yeah, and I heard,
let me take one more minute, if I could, just so I can, what's your...
The sum of money, the 30 pieces of silver, the gospel according to Judas, apparently, which was written later, said that Jesus went up to Judas and said, "You have to betray me, it's part of the plan," and then I guess he said, "Make it 30 pieces of silver." This is according to the gospel, according to Judas.
Yeah, the problem is Judas has a late date. Yeah. So it was written way after the events. It's not attributed to the Judas that would have been one of the disciples of Jesus. So scholars have looked at that as a bogus book.
Okay.
So that's the problem there. But see, it's not just that. Keep in mind that in Psalm 22, it predicts the exact words that the Roman soldiers would say to him, what the Jewish leaders would say to him, and the fact that they would throw dice for his clothing, and they would share their... So, I mean, these are all events way outside of his control or the control of the disciples. Yeah, how he predicted what the Roman soldiers would do. He predicted what the Jewish leaders would do. I mean, read Psalm 22 today.
Well.
Yeah, take a look at it and compare it with the gospel accounts. You'll be amazed. And I say that for all of you. It's a wonderful thing to look at as we prepare for Thanksgiving. Let me close in prayer. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for this day. We want to thank you for the opportunity you give us 2 weeks from now, but literally, Lord, every day, to give you praise and thanks for what you do in our lives. Lord, we thank you for the text we're now looking at, Psalm 139, which testifies, Lord, of what you do in the life of every human being and how we are the epitome of your creation here in this universe. As Lord, as much as you are involved in forming the universe for our benefit and forming all the life on this planet for our benefit, how much more you must be involved in all the events that take place in our life. Lord, may we realize that nothing happens in our life by accident. It's all under your control, all leading us to your Son. And Lord, I pray that each one of us would develop a more fulfilling and more emotionally satisfying relationship with the one that created us. In Jesus' name, amen.
Start off the ministry meeting luncheon. We'll be starting in a few minutes.
Should be microphone turned off.